I've got a huge ego. You'd be surprised.
Okay.
Not that big.
Hello, this is Sneaky Dragon. I'm Ian Boothby.
And I'm David Dedrick.
And we're going to be doing this American Lifestyle today.
Oh.
Lots of pauses.
These aren't going to work because I'm going to be using truncated silence.
Oh, screw it then. All right, forget it. Welcome to the show, everybody. I'm Ian. This is Dave. Want to give a shout out to one of our listeners that wrote us recently. That is Paul Franson from New Zealand.
Yes.
That's the best Zealand. The old Zealand just, that was a big piece of shit. Mm-hmm. But the New Zealand, I've heard nothing but good things about.
So you really hate Holland that much?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Is that what Zealand was? Was it Holland?
Yeah.
Well, they changed it to Holland because they were ashamed. They knew as well. Zealand, boo. But New Zealand, fantastic. But he wrote us and he thanked us for our show. And he didn't thank us for being, you know, entertaining. He didn't thank us for being like edgy or covering topics and saying the things that need to be said that no one else has the nerve to say.
That's totally our role here.
No, he said, okay. He's telling it like it is.
Yep.
Telling it like it was.
Sure.
Telling like it.
Telling it's like it's backwards.
Then. That's right. Okay. No, he was saying thanks. He uses us to fall asleep. So he lays out like about 8 hours of our show, okay, and plays it, uh-huh, and apparently puts him right out. And he used to listen to old episodes of Dad's Army,
okay,
and sometimes a Star Trek trivia podcast, okay, but they don't have the snoozing power of us, Jack. We knock him right out cold. So he says thank you to that. And
wow.
He said, don't take it as an insult. Take it as a compliment. And he really appreciates it. So listen, however you use the show.
That's fine, I guess.
As a sedative, as a suppository, we don't care how you use it. As long as you use it and you enjoy it, we're mm-hmm very happy. And right now, we're going to sing a little lullaby for you to help put you to sleep, specifically.
Okay? Go to sleep. Go to sleep, close your big New Zealand eyes.
That's sheep.
Yes.
I know, you don't like, I know, New Zealanders, we're more than just sheep, I understand. But you do have a fair amount of sheep.
That is their national motto.
And that's why it's amazing, mm-hmm, with all those sheep to count, they would ever have any problem sleeping.
Yeah.
It seems like that's a country to just be like out cold constantly because of the sheer amount of sheep.
Yeah.
But there you go. Yeah. So
their actual national motto is "There's mutton going on."
That's right. It's bah humbug all year long. And the other thing I wanted to mention was if you are listening to this on this Saturday, like that's when we normally drop the show, you've got a week to prep for our live show.
Yes.
And, I'll just tell you.
Make your banners.
Make your banners.
Make your costumes.
Homemade pants.
Get your Ian cosplay going.
Don't make any shirts, because we're going to probably have some shirts for you, probably a couple shirts kicking around. But make homemade pants, because we're not making pants. So if you got, make some Sneaky Dragon pants.
Yeah.
May 21st, that's a Saturday. That's 5 p.m. We're going to be at VanCAF, that is the Vancouver Comics Arts Festival. And we will be there with guests Lucy Bellwood, a cartoonist who does a comic called Baggy Wrinkles and so many others. James Lloyd, who is best known probably for his work on the Futurama comics, but he also has done like The Trip and many other comics of his own that are just brilliant. He will be there as well, and we'll all be having a big old Yap Fest.
Yes.
And a good time had by all. And it'd be a better time if you showed up. And we might even take some questions. And we might even give away some prizes. That sounds like the kind of thing we'd probably do.
Yeah, we'll have to find some.
Yeah. And there you can actually hear the pauses live. We cannot edit them out.
We cannot edit them out.
If they're live. It's only going to be about 45 minutes.
Of
pauses. We will then put the episode up. Maybe that night. Maybe in a week. We'll see.
Did I mention I'm going to a concert that night?
Are you going to a concert that night? Yeah. Okay. So what does that mean?
Means it'll be hard to get the show up
one night. Oh, okay. All right. So fair enough.
We'll see.
We will see what's and we will see who's. Do you have to leave early from the podcast?
Oh, no.
Okay.
It's, I think, at like 9 o'clock or whatever. But.
Oh, it's fine then. It's all going to be fine.
I'm not going home.
Hey, we may even put the podcast up on a Saturday instead of a
Sunday, you mean?
A Sunday instead of a Saturday. That might happen.
Ugh.
Oh.
It really hurt my OCD.
All right. Fair enough. We'll see what goes on. But yeah, it'll be great to see you there. And it's free.
Mm-hmm.
come on down. The whole festival is Saturday and Sunday. We'll also be tabling there, so come say hey. Yeah, that's about it. That's the plug for VanCalf. The plug for TCAF is if you're at Toronto Comics Arts Festival, I will not be there, but my wife Pia will be there. So go say hi to my wife Pia, cartoonist who did the Why the Last Man book and many other things.
Yes.
So go say hey to her.
Is she there right now?
She will be leaving, when we are broadcasting this, yes. Right now in real time, when we're recording this on a Thursday, no. Yeah.
Okay.
No.
That's right. You're going out for dinner tonight.
We're
going
to go out for dinner this evening because we are celebrating our 10th anniversary.
Which is the... Which anniversary is that?
That is the metric anniversary.
Decimal anniversary.
Yeah, because it's the 10th.
You're right.
Yeah,
you're
that's right. How it goes.
You give your loved one a ruler.
Yeah. I remember the first one was paper. We spent that in Bristol. And then after that, who knows? I have no idea what it is for the 10th anniversary.
I can't be...
The 10th anniversary is, oh my gosh, we made it to 10 years. Good for us. Hooray.
You think that's what it is?
Yay. Hooray.
What if it's 22 years?
What happens at 22 years?
I don't know. That's what my wife and I just had. That's what Lisa and I just had.
Oh, okay. All right. So. Well, 22 years, by that point, it depends. If you had kids right away, it means it's sort of a start to a new sort of set of things because the kids are probably moving out around then, right?
I doubt it.
Nope.
I don't see that coming.
Sticky floors? Keeping them there?
Yeah. Well, I think less, it's not affordable for people to live outside of, you know.
When do you think people move out nowadays? I did the sticky.
I'm figuring moved out 45.
I moved out when I was 18.
Yeah.
Moved back in, I think, when I was late 19. Moved out again very soon afterwards. I moved back, I think, 3 times. Up until the point where I was, think, like 24. And
okay.
Then it was like, that was okay. The permanent then move out. I can't be doing this anymore.
Mm.
Yeah. I did a couple of boomerang things there. One was because I had mono, and so basically I was completely knocked out for months and months and months.
Yeah,
and
couldn't that's do terrible. Nothing. Yeah, you can.
Yeah.
The kissing disease.
Mm-hmm.
You got it from kissing?
I don't know where I got it from, but I assume. You can also get it from a glass. You can get it from many things.
You were kissing a glass?
Yes.
Mm.
George Glass, my boyfriend George Glass, who later went on to date Jan Brady.
Jan Brady.
That's a deep cut if you break the glass and you try to kiss it.
That is a very deep cut.
When do you think
I get
people move out now? Because, yeah, the idea of like moving out when you're 18 seems kind of ridiculous kind of now. It's like, where are you going? How are you getting out of here? Unless you're going to college somewhere, you know, out of state, out of province. You know, I really can't see how
you swing it. Yeah, because I think it's different. That's probably the way is to leave home and go and live, like be in a dormitory or be living off campus and going to school. Because I really can't see, it's not like in the old days, like when our parents left high school with a high school diploma, they had a guaranteed, you know, that was like as good as a university diploma. You know, that was like... You've got made it through high school. You're ready for the workforce. Get out there and get a job.
And it was conceivable to buy a house. It was conceivable. Yeah. If you had a high school education, the idea of buying a house was not ridiculous. If you saved up and got a mortgage and, you know, did that business, you could.
I mean, now
it seems, especially in Vancouver, well, no, that's ridiculous.
It's stupid. Stupidly ridiculous.
Yeah.
Like that'll never, it's just, we'll never have the circumstances that existed when our parents... who can now rub it in her face what brilliant financial wizards they are. But we will never have the opportunity of buying a house that will one day be around what we're making a year.
Mm.
Like that will never happen to me, for instance. I will never be making whatever my house is worth a year. Unless, I shouldn't say I never will, but it's highly unlikely that I will ever be making that kind of money that, you know. Whereas my parents, you know, their first house was expensive. I'm not saying it wasn't expensive at the time. Of course, it felt like you're making a big purchase and it took a lot of saving and this is the same way for us to buy a house. It's the same kind of scary proposition.
Right.
But we'll never live through that crazy inflation of the 70s where suddenly your salary rose and your house, you know, what you bought your house for didn't go up. You know, you already bought it, so you don't have to worry about that, right?
I remember my parents once told me what they bought their house for, and this is in the 60s. In 1963, and they bought their house for $8,000.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my parents bought 66, I guess, for $15,000.
Right. It's now, I checked, because it was actually up for sale recently. It's now $120,000, which it sounds like, well, that's quite a bit. But then, of course, compared to a Vancouver price, you go, well, that ain't nothing. That's
This was in Quebec.
This is in Quebec. Yeah.
Okay.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah. No, the house that they bought here, I think they sold. Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I can't remember, frankly. You know, that was in like the late 70s, what they bought and sold it
I'll
for.
Give
but
it wasn't I'll give it
fantastic.
Away.
It wasn't a fantastic amount.
My parents bought for 15, sold for around 70, bought for 70 in 78, sold that house for close to $400,000 in the 90s. So that's a good, you know, that's a good return on your investment.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm doing okay. My house has gone up in value. Mm-hmm. You know, so I can't complain. I bought it.
Well, you discovered that gold in the basement as well.
Well, the gold mine.
Yeah.
Yeah. You dig where, you know, what we know now is that you dig where people were digging before. That's the new thing. I keep hearing this commercial on the radio for a mine. And their tag is that they're digging in an old gold mine, but they're going to find gold there again because that's where the gold is, where they found it before. Just remember that next time you need gold.
Okay.
That's I don't know. I don't. Does that make sense?
It kind of makes sense. Sounds like someone's too good for alchemy. I got all this lead lying around.
But it kind of makes sense. And if you,
it is a gold mine.
If you assume that our ways of mining now are more efficient and we can get into places that are more difficult to get into before or in the past, are now accessible, then maybe that's possible. I don't know. You know, I don't know. Maybe they're just filling it full of gold and pretending that it's going to have gold in it.
It's, well, that's what they used to do in old gold mine, gold rush days.
Yeah.
Is the people in the town who wanted to sell supplies would take some gold, sprinkle it in the river. Someone would go, hey, there's gold.
Yeah.
And someone would go, yeah, there's gold. We found gold. And then, of course, all the mining supplies and everything in the town lights up and it's fine. And people are looking for gold until they go, there's no more gold.
Yeah.
And it's like, but they've already bought the shit. So, you know, either they sell it back and then they resell that again and keep the thing going. But yeah, it was a scam. Yeah, always. Well, there was some gold.
Always. There was,
some gold. Yeah. But then other towns would just go, you make money off the people who are. The whole town didn't go, fuck it, we're going up to the river and we're all going to go gold panning. And, you know, someone did work the shop that sold the picks and that person did well.
Yes. Yes, that should make you pause and think to yourself, why is everyone still working in the town when you could be grabbing nuggets out of the water up at the creek?
Right. It's like anyone who's telling you real estate secrets.
Yeah.
You're just like, why are you telling these secrets if they work?
Yeah.
You know, why are you telling people where the genies and the lamps are instead of just going and getting those genies yourself?
Yeah.
Yeah. Here's the things
the government... My surefire way to make money in real estate.
And then why don't you show us you on a boat with some pretty ladies?
Because
that makes you look classy.
Sure.
And I trust this guy. He really knows. I should go to his real estate seminar.
Well, I have a surefire. My tulip investing seminar. It's hot. It's a hot property.
That's right. You got a kissing booth and your two lips just keep going all day. In fact, Dave will be doing that at VanCalf. So pucker up, everybody. And please, no mono. We just do not have time for that.
I don't have time for mono. I really don't. I don't have time for it.
No one's got time for mono.
That sounds like a lot of work. 8 months of heavy slogging.
Though it is a bit of a money saver in that you only eat, if I remember correctly, half a sandwich a week. That's what I remember eating one week was like half an egg salad sandwich and I was done for the week. And then the rest of it was just like drinking juice occasionally or water when I'd wake up and go, watch some TV. Oh, Leave It to Beaver. Then go to sleep. Wake up. And that was the new Leave It to Beaver. Oh, they've aged. I've traveled through time. And then back to sleep. And then occasional throwing up. Because it is like basically having the flu for months.
Yeah.
Ah, it's great stuff.
Sounds
really
nice.
Deeply exhausted. You're more asleep than you are awake.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, good stuff.
And the difference is? That was a bit of a burn, everybody. Hey, I was watching a video on the internet.
Your VHS.
On my VHS. I was watching a video by a guy telling tips for successful tabling at conventions.
Oh, yeah.
Did you see that too?
Yeah.
The guy in a car?
What's the guy in the car? Yeah, I completely disagreed with like about 80% of what he said, yeah.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of odd myself.
Yeah.
For one thing, just talk to me. Why are you driving a car wearing sunglasses and yelling advice? Like, doesn't make any sense. Like, is that more exciting, more dynamic?
Yeah, you kind of want someone to pay attention to their driving while they're in a car. Mm. Like, if you can't text and drive, you really shouldn't vlog and drive. You know, that's not the best idea in the world.
But he...
Do you remember the specific ones? Because I don't really.
Well, the one I remember
that... I just remember going like, no.
The one I didn't like a lot was standing the whole time.
Right, because you want to make eye contact because you don't want to look in the guy's crotch.
Well, what if I like crotches? You know? Mm-hmm. And then get rid of your chairs.
Yeah.
Wait a second. I like to rest. I'm a person who I like resting.
He's one of these always be selling guys. Mm. Always be looking for the person. Okay, they're now talking to them. But, you know, it's when you talk to these kind of guys, and I admit it's a business. I get it. You know, you're not going there to make friends, man. But I just find a more casual approach.
What about his advice that you should buy the products from the people on either side of you?
It seems a little cheap. You know, it seems like a bit of a cheap move, and then you're kind of pressuring them now to buy your shit.
Yeah.
And so now everyone's awkward, and we've all had to exchange money, you know, off the top.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I think what you do, I like buying the stuff as I'm leaving.
Yeah.
You know, because then it feels like, you know, I know them, probably I've talked to them a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I've probably sent people over to their table, and then I go, oh, I'd like to pick up one of these too. And I haven't taken comics away from them selling them to real people.
Yeah.
And also, when you do that, usually then they feel obligated off the top to go, oh, just take one. Because it's weird to sell to the person next to you.
Yeah.
So now we're trading, and it's like, ugh. You know, just gross. So just do it at the end and like give them a little extra money and just go, no, it's fine. I want to do this. And yeah, I prefer that. Do see what they're doing. Ask maybe a little bit if they're not too busy setting up.
Yeah.
You know, be polite, but you don't have to do that because that feels, you know, it feels like you're doing it to do it.
Some of advice seem fair enough. Like, you know, mark your prices clearly so people know they don't have to ask you what it is. You know, because it takes away an awkward moment in your exchange, which is the what am I looking at and what does it cost?
Yeah, am I buying it for $2? It's $10. Ugh, now I got that. It's Xerox this, man. It's $10. I can buy like two real books for this. You know? Really? Okay. All right. That's what we're doing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's printed on some glossy paper.
Some of it is.
It's 4 pages long.
Yeah, that is true.
Printed glossy paper. So it's about my feelings. $10? You don't want it? Hello? Why are you walking away?
I mean, it is weird because, like, I understand, like, a lot of artists, myself included, are a bit socially awkward. So when you're sitting behind a table and you've been working on this thing, staring at an art table for, you know, weeks, 2 months, and then putting it all together, and then you're out in public with an extreme amount of people, and then it's all these people come up and going, like, what's this about? I mean, have that planned.
Yeah.
You know, have it planned.
Well, that's a good thing. He didn't say that, but you should have your
explanation / pitch.
I was going to say elevator pitch.
Yeah, your elevator pitch. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I prefer my excavator pitch. That seems to be the way that I go. Is I just dig myself a really deep hole trying to tell people what I. It's just some stupid stuff. You know, I can't really draw very well, so it's dumb.
They call me Davey Dumb Drops.
This dumb stuff.
Yeah.
Dumb. Dumb, dumb.
It's basically the same thing we have to go through when we have to describe the podcast, though. You know, like my comic was just like, it's some autobiographical stuff, some comedy stuff. It's all over this. Whatever I feel like doing. And what's the podcast about? Just listen to it. You'll kind of get it.
I want to hire that guy who came by last year. I want him to be our publicity agent.
Oh, the guy that figured out what Sneaky Dragon was all about,
yeah.
Like in the illustrations?
Like in 1 second.
Why don't you say what it was? Feel free to repeat that.
Oh, yeah. I think we talked about it. But yeah, he just wandered by.
A year ago. It's cool. We can say it once a year.
Sure, we can say
it
once a year.
That's all right.
But just kind of set it up. I don't want to put this guy down because he seemed like a nice guy. But he didn't look like... He looked a little rough. Is that fair? Looked a little rough around the edges?
I don't remember what he looked like.
Oh, you don't remember what he looked like?
No.
He looked a little bit like...
Oh, you mean that fucking hobo who came by?
That was a hobo.
No.
He did kind of look like a hobo. He wrote some symbols on her table. Easy marks.
Good eats.
Good eats.
Hot wife.
And thank you. And so he came by and you're kind of like, oh, this guy's not going to buy anything. You know, he's just looking around. And he just wandered in with the crowd. Like, this place looks warm. I guess that's what he was thinking. I don't know. So he comes by the table and he's looking at the drawings and stuff. And he goes, oh, I get it. The dragon sneaks into pop culture stuff. And then I was just like, why didn't I think of that? Because I never thought of it that way.
Right.
And all the time I've been drawing this, it just never occurred to me to summarize it so succinctly, sir.
Right.
Thank you.
If you were an actor, okay, it sounds like what he did was he Elvis Mitchell'd you. And are you familiar with Elvis Mitchell?
I don't know. I know Elvis Presley. Related? Okay. Are they related?
Nope.
They have the same first name.
No, he's a radio host.
Okay.
KCRW, I think, is the radio station. And he also is on a podcast called The Treatment, which, you know, he interviews people. And he's a very, very good interviewer and,
okay.
film critic. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes a TV critic. But he will always do a thing where he'll go like, I see all of your, hey, Shane Black, I see all of your movies have people going to Los Angeles and there's children involved. Does this mean that what you're saying is, sir, and he'll find a theme through all the movies. Mm-hmm. And of course, then the person...
You know you're making that up, right? It's not true.
What's that?
That Shane Black's movies are all about a person coming to Los Angeles.
And a lot of his films are people coming to Los Angeles, yes. That was one of the things he mentioned on a recent interview. And they almost always have a child involved, and the child gets in danger. Hmm. These are things that happen in Shane Black.
I mean, that's a common trope, I guess, in action films.
But he justified it in some way of like, are you saying that? And he was saying the reason for it. Is it this? And he went, yeah, you know, I never thought of it. But yeah, I guess so. And this is what he does with almost everybody. He'll go, you know, a common thing you have in all your movies is blah, 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 blah. And they'll go, oh, yeah.
It's called The Treatment. Hey, I'm looking for another podcast to listen to. I might check
it out. Oh, it's really good. Yeah, it's a great podcast. But then a lot of the actors retroactively go, you know, I never thought of it. But yeah, obviously, that is what I'm going for. It's like, no, you're not. You line up six things in a row. I will be able to find a common element in the six. Nothing was planned. You know, maybe something in your past will make you do these things. That is possible. But for the most part, you just put six things together and you're going to find a common thing. It doesn't mean there was a theme. It just means there's a similarities between these things. That's not a theme. A theme is something that's planned. A theme is something, you know, and it's true. You could have a subconscious theme. That could be. But he does it every time. Every time. And actors love to feel, because he does actors as well, love to feel that they have more depth than they do. And so they go, yes, that is correct. I've always planned that. And so I think like if you were being Elvis Mitchell by that guy, you'd go, yes, I didn't realize I was doing it. But clearly that's what the Sneaky Dragon is. He is sneaking into and commenting on pop culture. That is what Sneaky Dragon is about.
It just never occurred to me.
I know.
Like if someone took...
Because you haven't got the ego for it. But if you were a big shot...
I've got a huge ego. You'd be surprised.
Okay.
Not that big. It's pretty big.
You were Davy Dumdrops just a couple of seconds ago. What are you talking about?
Yeah, I have a hard time with the pitch.
Now, are you looking forward to seeing anybody at Van Calf? Speaking of the calf that is Van.
I'm looking forward to seeing all our wonderful listeners who are coming to see us.
True.
Sucking up to you, dear listener. No.
All right, then. Asked and answered.
I don't know. If I could actually talk to Lynn Johnson, that'd be...
I can't see how you couldn't if you went and you were willing to stand for more than 2 minutes.
Yeah,
I could see how you would be able to talk to Lynn Johnson.
Maybe we'd run into her before the show opens and that would be...
I think that would be 100%. Have you ever spoken to Lynn Johnson?
I've never spoken to her.
I've spoken to her a couple of times.
Hmm.
And, you know, bit Johnny Fumblemouth, nothing to say. You know, I really don't have much except, you know, enjoy your work.
That's good enough, isn't it?
Yeah. It's like if we were on a kind of situation where we're peers and we're both on a panel together or something, then I'd get more into it. But for the most part, it's been where she's doing a signing at a bookstore or some such. And it's like, well, what can you say besides good on you?
Yeah.
And I enjoy your dandruff, as we mentioned last week. not her personal dandruff, but the dandruff she draws on people. I like that she makes people look a little dirty.
And her personal dandruff.
Well, I don't know. I'd have to see. I don't see her wear a lot of black clothing. you know, how could you do this to Farley? You agree it was a great thing with Farley. So on and so forth. It got bizarre near the end, by the way, of her strip, where she was doing that thing where they went back in time.
Yeah.
And then, you know, she was sometimes doing the strip, and sometimes she would run classic strips, which in no way looked similar, because the styles were so jarringly different. Mm-hmm. So if you didn't know this was the situation, it would be very odd to you. But I think what she was trying to do was take out things that had, you know, old references. So, you know, if there's a television that doesn't look like a television, or someone's using a VHS, you know, much like you do, you know, they take that out because it would make it look inappropriate. You know, and all the racial slurs that she had in the early strips.
Right.
Yeah. Which were funny then.
They were so funny.
A lot of blackface.
Yeah.
Take it out. Take it all out.
Japanese character Sammy Urai.
Isn't it, by the way, amazing?
Mm.
And maybe I'm wrong. But when you when you look at like a strip that ran as long as Peanuts, you can run any one of them now and you don't feel, oh boy.
That's true, isn't it?
It really is.
Mm-hmm.
Much more
than... What about Franklin? Does Franklin ever make you feel...
No, I think Frank. Well, did you ever read the letters about like Frank, the Franklin letters, like why he?
No, I have not read the Franklin letters.
Well, there was a thing where
was there a book called the Franklin Letters that published the correspondence between Franklin?
There are books with the Franklin letters in it.
Okay,
which is a woman wrote to Charles Schulz going, "Could you please put a black character in this? You know, really help." And he was like, "Well, you know, I don't want to just force a character in and this and,
and it doesn't really, it's not his, I don't know anything about it, you know, if,
right." And then later, and then later on, as kind of the civil rights movement was going on, he went, "Yeah, I gotta put a black hand in it. I've got to."
Yeah.
So he did. And then like a bunch of the newspapers, canceled the strip, you know, idiots. As you do, cause they're idiots.
Yeah.
And you know, oh, here it comes. It's in, but you read those strips. Mm-hmm. And there's no big focus on that at all. He's just a kid.
Yeah.
They do their standard jokes and, you know.
Yeah.
And there you go. Moving on.
He's just another kid who needs a psychiatrist.
Yeah. They're all a mess. If he was the well-adjusted kid, that would be bullshit then, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
A lot of anxiety issues.
Everyone's a total mess. Mm-hmm. In that strip, but yeah,
the hilariously titled "My Anxieties Have Anxieties."
Right, but and maybe I'm mistaken. Maybe there's a couple of ones that you're like Snoopy's doing a joke, you know, about a Chinese waiter that I can't think of.
It's pretty unfair to Germans.
but they were all dead, right? It's all World War One Germans. It's not even jokes about World War II, which would be maybe a little bit weird now. But World War One, it was already so far away that like, it's fine.
Yeah,
knock yourself out. Yeah, but like to have that many decades of strip, even the attitudes towards women generally, you know, the female characters were always strong.
Peppermint Patty is a great character.
Peppermint, and we're now getting into feminism with Peppermint Patty and like, you know, women's rights and whatnot in the 70s. I'm talking like the original Patty. By the way, Peanuts had two patties. Anyway, please enjoy last week's show. But the original Patty and Violet.
Ian's here all week.
And all these, you know, would be just jerks to, before Lucy became kind of the real jerk, were real jerks to Charlie Brown.
Yes.
They were as much bullies, even more bullies than the boys, frankly, had more power than the boys. And then
from the very first strip.
Yeah, and there was never a thing where, like, you know, Charlie Brown or Lucy were like, not Charlie Brown and Linus were like, "Get out of here, you skirts. Yeah, go make me some pancakes."
Yeah.
There was none of that.
No, you're right.
It was just they had as much power. All the kids had equal power in the strip, which is bizarre when you look at like.
It's bizarre in a way, but I think it's true to my experience as a growing up. I didn't feel like the girls were separate from us when we were playing.
Right, but then you look at like you know, any other comic strips around the time. It's like, hey, what's going on in BC? Well, there's the fat broad who's doing jokes about this. Well. And you know they were like there was a lot of I could look back
different,
and like find
different sensibility there obviously.
Different sensibility, but I'm trying to think of like a parallel strip
that
would have run that amount of time that you'd go ooh boy, you know, now it's not go ooh boy nowadays.
You
know,
but you could look at any of that. I mean, if you want to find, I mean, I agree with Schulz. I mean, Schulz was coming from a totally different mindset than any of what you're talking about. You know, and what's interesting about him is that, you know, his beliefs. Or integrated into the story in a very natural way. You know, when Linus quotes from the Bible, you don't go, ugh. Whereas when it happened in BC, you were like, this is, no.
Because it felt like with BC,
forced.
Either accept God or you're all damned.
Yeah.
And in Peanuts, it was like, hey, you know what Scripture says about this?
Yeah.
And then it's not
I mean.
You all believe in Scripture, right? We're all going to church on Sunday, says Linus, or there's going to be some trouble. He doesn't care. He only cares. He goes to a great pumpkin. He's got a lot of beliefs.
He's apparently a pantheist.
He's a pantheist.
Whatever.
Sure.
But
a wild-eyed pantheist.
But with BC, it, you know, it didn't feel integrated into this universe. It just felt like this thing that suddenly kind of got, you know, nailed onto it. You know, this banner is, you know, the comic strip has to carry this, unnaturally carry it because it never existed before. It was always a very wry, ironic, sardonic, you know, pretty mean-spirited comic strip. You know, there's very little in BC where you go, oh, that's heartwarming. That's not what
it was.
Right?
It was just clever and sharp.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, zip, zip, zips. And then, you know, I think generally just ran out of jokes. You know, you only got so many jokes in you. And
it's that, but I think also he converted.
Yeah.
He was born again. And which, you know, I can understand. Like, there's an incredible amount of enthusiasm when you first convert, you know, to Christianity or whatever, to whatever you convert to. If you just suddenly decide that, you know, drinking water is the best thing on earth and you want to tell everyone about it, well, you're going to be the biggest bore in the world on Facebook. He's talking about water all the time. You know, and it's the same with, you know, people who to born again. Of course it's boring because that's the most exciting thing that's happened to them and they want to tell it to you, you know, but you're right with Hart. It wasn't just that he was excited about it. It also felt like he's really pushing in your face and it was all very black and white.
There's and then occasionally he'd do like an anti-Clinton joke and it'd be like, and it's a caveman going down some white water who looks like Clinton. It's just like, oh, this white water. It's like, all right, buddy, you're not. Yeah. And all of a sudden an editorial cartoon just shows up. Yeah. But I think something like Peanuts, one of the reasons it also.
How did he do it? By himself too. Like Johnny Hart, I mean, he had a writing team. Like they would sit and spitball ideas.
I guess he approved it. You know, I was like,
because but how did Charles Schulz do it? Like Charles Schulz did it by himself. He didn't have a writing team. It was just a personal thing.
But,
it was so
but
amazing.
But I think the thing that also made the Peanuts succeed over time was if you look back at like the original ones, they look nothing like the later ones.
I love those ones though.
They're beautiful. Yeah, they're beautifully done.
Yeah.
But if it looked like that now. Or currently, or like near the end, it probably would have just seemed old. But he changed everything. Like he was willing to shake things up a bit and do some weird ideas.
Yeah. Everyone likes a Ziggy. Well, I guess I'll change my style to that.
Yeah. But like, you know, you have Snoopy and all of a sudden Snoopy's thinking and then Snoopy's on his hind legs. And now all of a sudden he's Joe Cool. And he's, I mean, the idea of him fighting World War One, like, what the hell is that? That's crackers. What's he now? He's an author. Can he write on a typewriter? Can they read his writing? Why doesn't he just communicate through the typewriter? He can clearly write what is think. What's this surreal?
Do you think that the doghouse had a mansard roof? You know, like angled and then flat on the top, though. So angled sides, but then flat. Otherwise, I can't see how a typewriter stayed.
I don't
up
think
there.
It works in 3D.
No, you can't. You can't do it in 3D. I've not seen the new Peanuts film.
Yeah, I'm guessing they do not show it from the side. I've seen other people do it, or I've seen toys of the roof, and they make it flat on top, and it's like, no, man, that's not the deal. The gag is, lying on a sharp roof. Yes. That's hilarious that's the comfortable that's thing for him. Gag. It's not funny if it's flat.
You're right.
It's only funny if it's sharp, and then the rest of it just goes from there.
Okay, what's the best thing that Snoopy was?
What's the best
thing? Well, like his imaginary. I have one of mine that I love so much. But what? Do you want me to say mine first?
Well, I can't. Okay, the best thing was the World War One Flying Ace.
That's your favorite one?
It's not. Is it my favorite one? I'm trying to think of. Like, I got my favorite one is him as the vulture.
Okay, that's me too. Yeah, the vulture is the greatest thing.
Yeah,
there's a vulture in the tree.
It's the best drawn. It's gorgeous.
Fantastic.
He's just like staring at things. Yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think the most mileage you got out was the World War One. Oh yeah, and also it's the most bizarre. What do you mean he's a World War One flying ace dog? Yeah. What's that mean?
And it was,
he's fighting the Red Baron.
And it was
What's that about?
Great on the weekends because then you get the full on like fully drawn backgrounds with the barbed wire and the going to the I assume it's a French pub, whatever they would call
it. Yeah, drinking root beer with the French girl, and she's giving him some information, and she loves him, but he's got to leave her because he must go.
You never see her, of course,
fight the Red Baron, and off he goes. Well, once in a while, there was a little girl with dark hair you'd see. Yeah, that was a little later, and
that must be later on.
They justified it later, but then when you talk later on about how amazing Calvin and Hobbes was, you know, it's like, yeah, but Schulz was doing this stuff in the 60s, man. He was doing that, and really some beautiful drawings, too. I know, near the end, got a little shaky hand, couldn't do as much.
Well, he'd had a stroke, right, and had to relearn to draw with his left hand.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just amazing, yeah.
So that's one. He always had a bit of a shake. I remember the time I tried to draw like him. It was very difficult because it's hard to imitate someone's idiosyncratic style in that, especially when it's Tremory or whatever. There's the only other there's another cartoonist who I think his name was H.T. Webster or something like that. I only know him because for whatever reason they put out a collection of his cartoons when I was a kid, and it was in our library at a local library. So I got it out because it was cartoons, and man did I learn a lot about the hilarity of bridge. The hilarity of bridge. But yeah, this he was drawing.
Any of those Trump jokes work with the political structure going out today?
Maybe. I don't know if it was Trump jokes. It was more interpersonal, like the dynamics of a husband and wife playing.
I understood. Kicking her feet under the table, huh? Yeah, come on.
You trumped my clubs, or whatever. I don't know the words for. I always ignore that. Ace of Bridge, isn't it?
I also want to see a cartoon there where like, you know, they're doing that and it's a cartoon from like the 50s and one like looks at the other and goes like, I can't wait till swinging's a thing because this is boring.
What, what's this?
Oh, just thinking like the couples coming over and playing bridge. Okay, eventually they became the 70s.
Yeah.
Key
yeah.
nights.
That's why it became the 70s. Key yeah. But he drew like in that kind of old timey pen and ink, lots of lines and stuff style. But he had a stroke and had to relearn to draw with his left hand. And you can't tell the difference in the between when what in the time period is. Yeah.
Like, I think when you
H.T. Webster,
when you're talking about how difficult it is to draw in the Schultz style, it's because it is a flaw.
Mm-hmm.
And it's you can copy someone if they're doing it right,
yeah.
but it's tough to copy someone's flaw.
Yeah.
Yeah, because naturally, you, I think, as an artist, are trying to do it the right way. And so you can't go,
yeah.
you got to do it the wrong way.
Like, exactly.
No, I can't. Ah, it doesn't work.
Because my drawing model of always is Warren Kramer, who designed all the like Richie Rich and Casper and stuff like that, and did a lot of the art for those. And so that style, that super smooth line and everything, that's what I love and what I always try to imitate, never successfully.
There was something that Schultz did that I used to really like too. He didn't do it a lot, but it was where they had the massive discussions on the pitcher's mound, and it would be all these philosophical questions, mm-hmm. and it would be word balloons filling the entire page.
Yeah.
And later on, you know, you'd have Family Circus, and they do a similar thing where it's like all the, which I always like looked at. It's like, ah, you can have mediocre gags, but you have so many that a couple of them are going to hit. Ah, that's good. That's smart. No one knows then that some of these are weak. You know, there you are. But yeah, like you look at Linus, and you know, in the early strips, he was what he was. And then he wasn't the philosophical, mm-hmm. let me tell you about, you know, Jesus, you know, at any point. And it wasn't even that. It was just like he just dropped some Corinthians out at you.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like
it was very pithy. Like it fit the scenario, but it was interesting. And I think we've talked before about something I love, which is that Charles Schultz's. He did drawings for church newsletters, so you could use his cartoons in your church newsletter. And they were like more teens. Like they were kind of like the Peanuts. Only their legs were longer.
Right.
And so they're more teens.
Well, that was his original style, too. Like, his Saturday Evening Post comics had the long, long, lanky teens.
Yeah. And so these were like a series of, and some of them are theological, but a lot of them are just more about like the social life of being church kids or whatever. And they're great. I think I've talked about it. And my favorite one being the tonight's discussion, what was bugging old Pharaoh? I think it's a great line. But yeah, there's two or three of those books I treasure them.
Nice. Yeah, he's let's all agree, Schultz was great.
Have you ever seen the book The Gospel According to Peanuts?
Yes.
Yeah. That was kind of popular, I guess, in the 70s, during that.
I read anything that was Peanuts at the library.
That's
just
thing.
Devoured it.
Yeah, yeah.
It's all great. And I think like as a kid, you like seeing kids that are smart. And mm-hmm. it never was jarring to you that this kid was quoting philosophy. You're just
he's
a smart kid. I'm smart.
Sure.
This kid's bummed out. Yeah, I'm bummed out. And I think like his parents, you go, well, kids don't get bummed out. You know, they're happy all the time or they're, you know, being jerks or whatever.
Yeah.
And you see like a lot of comic strips about kids, like let's say a High and Lois, you know, and it's like, can't relate to those kids.
They're not
those
kids.
Those kids are fucking idiots.
They're
you know,
not,
and
they're not kids; they're just ciphers.
That's right. And the teenage boy, he's just lazy all the time. That guy's a real lazy lump.
He's always lazy. Now he's texting.
Well, now he is. Yeah,
so much texting.
And he looks just like Beetle Bailey because Lois's brother is Beetle Bailey, and he's just as lazy as him. But lives in a world where I guess Sarge can't beat people like him. I don't know. Beetle lives in a much more violent world, but luckily he never has to go to war. So good for him, even though he's in the army all the time.
Hey, you know. Only, what did Robert Heinlein say? I think he said like only one-fifth of the armed services actually fight.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of it's all support.
I thought the rest of it's all Beetle Bailey gags.
It's all Beetle Bailey gags. It's all guys hanging from trees off over a cliff.
Captain Hardtack, is that, what was it? What was the guy who was always like looking at Miss Buxley and like, oh, I'd like to.
General, isn't it?
General Hardtack, is that his name?
Half-Track?
Half-Track, that's what I think it is. That's it, yeah.
I don't know.
I'd like to do so. And then Mort Walker would always draw naked pictures of Miss Buxley for people. And you look at her and just go like, well, she's a very cartoony character.
Yeah.
But whatever works for you before pornography is allowed.
And really, you could just white out the line of her dress. because the dress is so tight that it really is like she's...
Well, that was the old trick, you know, when they had those magic eraser kind of drawing things. Remember those? Where it was like, it was kind of black tarry thing, and then you had like a gray sheet over it, and you could draw on it. And then you could just pull it up quick, and it would like erase the thing you drew.
Sure.
Well, now the fun thing to do there, of course, is you can trace a drawing of Wonder Woman and then draw some extra bits. And there you go.
Nice.
Yeah.
Did you ever...
And then immediately go... And then, mom can't see unless she like looks at the piece of tar that now clearly has the etched image of all that stuff in it.
She doesn't care. She's not going to look. Did you ever... I did this, so I'm curious if you did. Did you ever steal gags from Charles Schulz?
For what?
I would draw my own... With my own characters, I would draw out peanut sequences.
Not that I can remember.
When I was in grade 6, I was a terrible thief.
And where would you put these drawings?
I wouldn't put them anywhere. I would just do them for myself.
Then it wasn't really stealing.
Well,
it was just practicing drawing. Because you're not selling them. You're not promoting them as your own work.
I was not selling them.
That is in no way stealing.
Okay.
Okay, let me tell you about the time I stole the Mona Lisa. Where I drew a picture of it, and I kept it to myself. I'm a real thief. Also stole a bowl of apples.
I just think... It is kind of stealing. I mean, you're taking someone else's jokes.
And presenting them as your own?
I'm not selling them or anything. No, I didn't present them as my own.
Then you didn't steal them. It's only stealing if you, like, took
something. But I wasn't making up my own things. I was taking someone else's stuff and you know.
Yeah, that's how all art starts, is you borrow and then you do a thing. Yeah, and you're not even presenting the elements of that as your own. You're just practicing.
No, you're right.
That's practice.
Yeah, I did a lot of that.
Yeah, it's nothing. Don't feel guilty about that.
I still do it.
Okay, I feel guilty about it.
I do it every week and present it as my own work.
I know, but you know the deal, what I've heard is this: the dragon just sneaks into pop culture.
That's right.
Gets in there. Now, speaking of churches.
Churches?
Being the worst fried chicken. Yeah, the worst fried chicken.
Is it the worst?
Oh, it's pretty damn terrible.
First place I had a jalapeno pepper, though.
Yeah, when it was exotic.
Yeah, it was exotic. You're like, whoa, what is this thing?
Oh, boy, I tell you, I don't know. What's this mayonnaise? I don't know. By the way, we settled that whole McChicken mayonnaise situation from last week.
Did we?
Yeah.
To your satisfaction?
You never look at our page.
I did look at it. I didn't click on the link, though.
Okay.
Because I'd already read it, and I know that it says it's different because we use different starches.
Yeah, different starches.
And I'm like, what the fuck does that mean? It sounds like you're just running around the block pretending something's happening and it isn't.
Oh, they want it thicker, I guess, than the mayonnaise.
No, it's just garbage. It is a bit thicker than... No, is it? I don't know. Maybe it is thicker. They put potato in it. That's their thing that's different.
Okay.
They put potato in there.
Why not? And then they put meat in their potatoes and they put everything. Or they used to. Used to put beef tallow in their French fry
They still do.
Oil. No, they don't.
Oh, did they? Well, that's great. Now they use a flavoring agent that imitates
yeah,
the...
Yeah, well, it is great if you're a vegan and you don't want to eat beef. And yeah, then you got to like...
yeah, it's great. Now they can have the chemicals rather than the beef tallow.
Yes, that's what vegans want. They want. We'll rather have
they
a
want
chemical.
Chemicals. They
yes.
want chemicals. But
yes, not... That's the
that
situation.
That doesn't sound healthy, guys. Guys,
or if it's a religious thing, yes. And speaking of religion, see, I can double segue even when I get derailed. You've got something religious in front of you. Why don't you explain what it is?
Well, you wanted to talk about this, so I brought it back. This is Mary wept over the feet of Jesus. The
Chester Brown. It's about your daughter.
What's that?
It's about your daughter.
It's about my daughter. When Jesus came to our house and was so upset and was weeping over her feet. And we're still not clear.
Oh, sorry, I do want to interrupt for a real quick story about someone coming over to the house real fast.
Okay.
So my cat's trying to wake me up.
You have to segue back into this, though. Naturally.
I will okay. completely do this, and it'll make sense. I'll segue away religiously. So we had like a bunch of days where I wasn't able to sleep late, and I was like, we're gonna sleep in late no matter what on Friday. We're gonna sleep in late on Friday.
Yeah.
Cat's on me going meow, meow, meow. Like, come on, cat. We had a deal, man.
Yeah.
Meow, 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 meow. It's like, oh, what's going on? Get up in here. Pat-a-pat-a. I was like, okay, well, there's a scatting jazz band going on in the kitchen, or, oh, shit, the ceiling's leaking again.
Yeah.
And the last time this happened, it was like toilet water was pouring in from above. Mm-hmm. Well, that happens again.
Ugh.
And we bang on the door. The neighbor's not there. We call the land, get all the things to catch the water, all the this, all the that. We're talking to the landlord or the building manager saying, you got to send a plumber over. He's like, have you turned off the water? Yeah, okay, we turned off the water. Okay, well, you know, we're out. It'd be very expensive today. I was on a Saturday, sorry.
Okay.
It'd be very expensive today. So. Oh, yeah. Doesn't matter because the water is pouring through the ceiling. We're not going to wait till a less expensive day. We're not going to have days of the water pouring through the ceiling. I know it's just really expensive. It doesn't fucking matter that it's expensive. You got to call a plumber. It's like, yeah, I guess so. Yeah, you guess so. So he's going to call. He'll be coming over in the next, you know, hour and a half. Okay, so we're doing the maintenance, trying to make sure everything's everything. Can't get upstairs. Worried, you know, that what the water is going to build up so much upstairs it'll break through the ceiling at some point because I don't know what's pouring through.
So you're picturing like the whole apartment filling with water? Like,
well, here's tank? The thing. The person upstairs just moved in and her father built a little 3-inch lip around this hole that was in the floor because that's where the water poured through last time when the toilet overflowed.
Okay.
So he went, listen, it's going to have to reach at least like more than 3 inches before the water gets to you. So now I'm thinking there's more than 3 inches of water up there. Yeah. And this is an old building. And yeah, I could see the ceiling collapsing from 3 inches of water up there for an hour and a fucking half. So
there's other places the water could leak, though.
There certainly is, Dave.
Yeah.
There certainly, it wasn't, though. It was from the toilet.
No, I just mean that it could be coming, like spreading out and then going under walls and then coming down towards
it could
unfortunate
be.
Folks.
Many things it could be. So we finally get that. Oh, okay, we're going to send over the plumber. So we're waiting. And finally we get a knock on the door. And it's this huge knock, just pound, pound, pound. I'm like, okay. It sounds like he's grumpy. I'm a little mad, but we got to get this done. So I just open the door with like a lot of intensity.
Yeah.
And it's the tiniest little girl selling Girl Guide cookies. Couldn't be smaller.
Will you buy some Girl Guide cookies?
Yes. Just reach in my pocket. Yeah. How much are they? $5 each. Okay, I'll take $2.
Which kind were they?
They were the ones, the chocolate and vanilla.
Oh, those are the best ones.
They are the best ones. You're absolutely right. The mint is okay. But
garbage.
It's kind of garbage. Okay, so shut the door. And I was like, it's just so intense with this little girl. I felt kind of bad about
you felt
that.
A little abashed.
And that's my story about my intensity in the door. And I said to Pia, we got cookies. Oh, my God. Speaking of religion, back to the book.
So, yeah, we talked about this a couple weeks ago, and you were interested.
A heretic.
Well, that's, yes. You were interested
heretic in. Heretic of the dog that bit him.
You were interested in, we seemed disturbed by, like, his readings of the prodigal son and the parable of the talents.
Yes.
And so,
wasn't disturbed, confused.
Confused, let's say that. We just, you seemed
explain
really,
how this works to me.
Yeah.
So you have since?
And of course, I hadn't read it, so I was like, I don't know. So I read it, and I was like, oh, I see why. Because he's making it up. That's why. There you go. Oh, good
to know. Is that really what was going on?
Mm-hmm.
Because the story of the prodigal son, basically, in this, like, as just to recap really quick, the story of the prodigal son I remember growing up with as a Catholic, was two sons. They both get some money. One son stays home, works on the farm. Other son goes, I'm out, going to have a good time. Woo, good time. And son goes, oh, who's good time? Ran out of money. Oh, no, things are bad. I'm going to go back home. Goes back home. Father goes, welcome home. Kills a fatted calf. They have a big feast. Son, who was at home all the time, what are you doing? What's the big deal? Why'd you happy him? It's like, well, you know, you were here and you are treasured, but a lost lamb that finds its way back, you know, will always be treasured more.
Yeah.
The end of story.
And it doesn't say treasured more, but yes.
Well, one that was lost and now is found has more value. I believe that was what we were told.
Hmm.
So it was basically a lost soul, someone who goes away from the Lord, and then we find again that is the greatest thing, more so than someone who is consistently with the Lord, you know, in belief. That is what I believe we were taught. Those of you who were taught religious things as well, let us know.
Interesting.
Does that seem like the story you were told? Because that's how I was told. Now, this story.
So, Chester Brown, what he does is he takes the end of the story and he has the father basically upbraid the son for, we can find it here. Prodigal son, you vamp while I
sure.
Here.
Or the other thing, you'd just be quiet, and it would then truncate silence, and that wouldn't matter. And
so they're celebrating. Say. They're celebrating, and someone says, "Sir, your other son is outside." And the father says, "Oh yes, I guess I forgot about him."
Right. Well, by the way, you've got to mention though that the son that left in this case wasn't just good time, he was prostitute.
Well, it says that in the Bible as well.
In the Bible as well? Okay, the Catholic stories when I was a kid, we did not
get
the prostitute.
They leave that stuff over.
Well, I don't know. This one isn't.
They're kids, so. They're not going to put that stuff in.
All right, go ahead.
So they said, tell him to come in. He says, he's refusing to. He's just standing out there. So the dad goes outside, sees the son. He says, come into the house, welcome your brother home. The son says, he went off and wasted his inheritance on whores. When he ran out of money, he groveled home. I don't know what that means.
Groveled?
Yeah, I groveled home, but you don't grovel home. You can grovel to come home, but you don't just grovel home. It's not a form of transportation. He didn't jump into a grovel and go home.
Well, I mean, I know the Hamburglar robble, robble, robbles home.
And you welcome him back with a celebratory feast.
That's the story of the prodigal Hamburglar.
Yeah.
And Grimace goes, but I was here the whole time. Why, Ronald? Why do you welcome the Hamburglar back?
The son says, I stayed here and slaved for you. I did whatever you told me to do. I obeyed you, yet you've never had a feast for me. Why is he the beloved son? The dad is silent for two panels and says, in his disobedience, your brother is alive. You and your resentful subservience are dead. Do you think God wants mindless worshipers who can only follow instructions? Okay, that's not how the story actually goes in the Bible. Like, Chester Brown has taken that story and changed it in a way that suits what he wants us to think about these stories. Fair enough. Like,
is it fair enough?
I'm not totally for that. I don't really agree with changing. To be fair to me and my being fair to the book. Yeah.
There is a lot of, he pulls a Dave Sim, where there is a lot of text at the back of the book explaining what the story we had just read is about.
Yeah.
And I did not read that because, you know, I just kind of went. I felt like a fella in New Zealand who just like went right to sleep at that kind of business.
I'll just say, I just want to say this about the prodigal son, which is that I think it's unfair to take that story, like to do this with that story, to take it out of its larger context. You know, it's probably one of the major parts of Luke. You know, this is like the heart of his gospel.
Could I ask who tells the story in the Bible, or where is it in the Bible?
Jesus tells the story. It's in Luke.
Okay. Is it only in Luke?
It's only in Luke, yeah. Okay. It's only in the Gospel of Luke. And the thing is that, like, his story, like, when Jesus tells his parables, he's putting his parables into a context that, you know, it's part of a larger message. So each, you know, there's a succeeding and preceding and proceeding stories that kind of echo things he's talking about. So it's unfair. So I feel like it's sort of unfair to take the stories out of context. That's easy to do. So you can have someone say, like, you know, if your hand offends you, cut it off. Well, that's not what Jesus was saying. If you just say that, of course, it sounds like Jesus is telling you to cut off your hand if it offends you. He's not. He's saying it's impossible to be this way. You know, so for example, if your hand offends you, cut it off. Well, you can't do that. He's not telling you to do it. He's saying that's a ridiculous way to look at, you know, obedience, right?
Is it? Because it feels to me, it says, like, get rid of the thing that is basically damning you. That feels like that would be the interpretation.
That's not what he's saying.
How do you know?
Because if you read the Sermon on the Mount,
it's
pretty clear. He gives you like a series of things, a series of steps that don't make
sense. So there's something before and after that makes it
that's not clear.
So
when you just make a pull quote,
right?
The other one would be like, the truth will set you free. Well, what does that mean?
Now, isn't it, by the way, if your eye offends you, pluck it out. Is that what it is?
That's another part of it. There's a series of things that he says in there, right?
Okay, so he's losing a lot of body parts.
Yeah, there's a lot of body parts flying every which way. But the truth will set you free is another one where people just pull that out, right? When the actual quote is like, if you follow in my word, if you are my disciple, you will learn the truth, and the truth will set you free. So it's not just the truth will set you free. It's if you follow Jesus' truth, if you follow his word, then you will be set free, right? Since not the truth. It's the word, right?
Okay.
But once again, it's easy to just pull it out of context and to sort of deliver it as a message. And then you're just kind of like, well, what does that mean? Like, what truth? Whose truth? What truth am I following here? So this parable is part of three parables that are presented in Luke. And like I say, I think they're kind of the heart of his gospel. And basically, they're all stories of God's grace, of God's gracious action in our lives. So you've got, and then also the stories are told to the typical Pharisees, although Luke is pretty fair to the Pharisees, unlike, say, Matthew, who's like really down on them, or John. Luke kind of tries to like sort of take the middle ground of all this because I don't know why. So they're shocked at Jesus' acceptance of sinners. Yes, prostitutes. Yes, tax collectors, all these other, you know, and whatever other sinners there were, gamblers and drinkers, I suppose. People who didn't follow the strict Mosaic code that had been elaborated over the generations.
Now, is he okay with them if they continue doing the thing, or is he only okay with them if they are repenting for the thing?
I think repentance was part of, you know, so someone like Matthew, who was a tax collector, once he joined as a disciple, he was no longer being a tax collector. And I think being a tax collector is fine.
Yeah, he didn't seem to have a problem with tax collectors, did he?
Tax collectors, no.
I'm using out of context render under Caesar, what is Caesar's? And,
but his problem with tax collectors was that they took advantage of their position to make money off the backs of their fellows, Jews. So rather than just collect tax for the Romans, they were taking money for themselves as well.
Gotcha. So would he have a problem, though, with a prostitute who kept being a prostitute? If someone was a prostitute, went, I want to come and follow you, or I'm sorry for being a prostitute, then I could see how he'd be fine. But if it's like, and I've got some more prostituting to do tonight, and the gambler's like, I'll see you later, I got a card game. Like, would Jesus be like, okay, we'll see you tomorrow?
I mean, it depends on where... So this is a hard...
And if you don't know, the answer is I don't know, and that's fine.
I'm not going to say I don't know. What I'm going to say is that the idea of sin as something that separates us from each other, that's a huge biblical theme, right? Mm-hmm. The idea of sin as a separator. So if the things that you're doing, if you're gambling, if you're being a prostitute, is something that separates you from your community and other people around you, then it's something that you need to change. If you're drinking to excess and it's affecting those around you, if you're lying to people to hide the fact that you have a gambling problem, then that's your sin, right? You're separating yourself from people. Like if you know that you have a problem and you're hiding it, then it's not okay that you do it, right? Mm-hmm. You'd say that. But whatever you're doing, whether it's buying so many books that your house is full of books, or drinking so much that you can't have a real life, whatever.
I guess that is just my question, is like, if there's a drinker who's drinking, who's still drinking, if Jesus is fine with that, or if he'd be constantly just saying, but you got to stop drinking.
Yeah, I think that would be his.
Okay, all right.
Yeah. So
be a prostitute, but once you're with me, stop being a prostitute. Whereas, I don't know what Chester's thing on this is.
Okay, we'll talk about that in a little bit. So there's three parables, and they all kind of present God in different ways. The first one is God is a shepherd. So, and that's the story, like, if you have 100 sheep and you lose one, you will leave the 99 behind to go and find that one. And then you will celebrate finding that one sheep.
Okay.
Which would have been, would have, nowadays, doesn't really resound with us. But at the time, sheep were pretty important. Lambs and sheep were pretty much the backbone of that economy. So this made a lot of sense.
Well, it's a nice story. It feels like that, to me, is like everyone matters. They all matter.
That's right. Yeah. The next one is God as housewife. And this is a story where he says, what woman who has 10 pieces of silver and loses one does not light a lamp and sweep the entire house looking for it? So once again, it's something that's so important that even though there's 9 others, the one that is lost will be God will seek.
Right. And unlike the lambs, the silverware will not wander off possibly from the drawer in the meantime.
That's part of it. Then the final one is God as father, right? And so to me, the parable of the prodigal son should really be called the parable of the loving father. He's the main part of the story. That's the one who has doing the action.
You say that as a loving father.
I say that as a loving father, exactly. And so now in the actual story, the older, after the fatted calf has been killed and everyone's celebrating,
right?
The older brother.
The story should be called the unlucky fatted calf. And the one calf who decided to keep slim and trim. Wait, I got a quick question. This is a really dumb thing. This is a super dumb thing.
Yes.
But I know VeggieTales has done this story. Okay.
They have done it.
I'm just curious if they had a fatted calf in the VeggieTales and if vegetables ate a cow.
That would be good. That would
be very weird.
Because it would be strange if it was a fatted carrot.
Yeah, because they're eating themselves.
Yeah, that would be wrong too.
Okay, go ahead.
So the older brother becomes angry and refuses to go in. So the father goes out to plead with him, and he answers his father, look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders. Yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours who has squandered your property with prostitutes comes home, you kill a fattened calf for him. And the dad says, my son, you are always with me and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and now is found. That's the story. He doesn't dismiss the older brother. He doesn't say, you're unimportant to me. He says, everything I have is yours. Mm-hmm. But, your brother was lost to us. Of course, we have to celebrate. So, the brother's being a little bit of a jerk, the older brother.
So he's not going out and going, you wasted your life being a slave to me, you fool.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
So when we think of the story, then, it's telling, it tells two things. One, of father's love, mm-hmm. and also forgiveness as love. Right? There's no recrimination. There's no holding it over his head. There's no, you know, it's just, that's it. In fact, in the story, the father goes to greet the son. He sees him coming and he leaves the house and goes out to greet his son coming home. Like he goes to his son.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just the son coming to him and begging to be back. His father goes out there and embraces him. You know, it's, there's no need for him to apologize. That's, you know, that's the story. Not the sort of silly, anyway.
No, it's okay. You can state your opinion on this. It's fine.
So the parables tell us about lost things, right? So we have sheep who are lost by foolishness. Mm-hmm. We have a coin that's lost by no fault of its own. So we could take that as a story of a person who maybe is misled in some way. And then the final one is someone who deliberately went away, someone who deliberately hardened their heart or rebelled, you know, but God will still forgive. That's the meaning of the story. Whether you believe in God or not, it's not important. Mm-hmm. I'm just stating what the stories mean in their original context before Chester decides to slightly change the ending to give it a different feel.
Where is he pulling this from? And I know you're going to say his ass.
Well, that story he is kind of pulling it from his ass. Like, okay, Chester does a classic thing that you'll notice with people who have a axe to grind and want to present it to you, right? Mm-hmm. So let's take his reaction to Matthew's genealogy. So you know that Matthew opens with a genealogy before we get to the Christmas
I don't really
story.
Know that, but okay. Go ahead.
So in Matthew, when you start reading the Gospel of Matthew, the first thing you get is a genealogy of Joseph. So it tells the lineage of Joseph, tracing him all the way back to Adam, to David, from David to the exile, from the exile to Christ. So three important stages of Jewish history are represented in Joseph's lineage. You have, you know, the great times, you know, when we were with God, I guess, when the Jewish people, you know, were at their greatest moments, you know, King David, then their downfall into exile, and then their possible, once again, rise to greatness with Christ. That's what he's presenting. You know, and I've often wondered about it, though, which doesn't make sense to me, is why is he presenting a lineage of Joseph? Joseph isn't Jesus' father. I thought that was the point of the story, is that, you know, Jesus is born in some way to Mary without Joseph having to do any work. Mm-hmm. So not that it's a terrible job, but without having to, you know, he doesn't do anything. Mary's pregnant, but we get his lineage. It's not Mary's lineage. It's Joseph's lineage. Anyway, seems odd, but okay. So, he ranges like that. So the genealogy stresses two things about David for Matthew.
Maybe it's just nice to focus on a loving father. You know, what's wrong with being a loving father?
Nothing.
Joseph, loving father. You used to be pro-loving father. Now you're really not the loving father thing right now.
So he was trying to establish like that Jesus was son of David, because this is very important in the prophetic tradition, right? Which Matthew's very much, very, like he spends a lot of time like quoting from Elijah and stuff like that, even though he's quoting wrong. Quite often he's like just paraphrasing or even like misquoting things to make them work. Like, this will fit like this. And then that Jesus was a fulfillment of the prophecy, obviously. So now the interesting thing about the genealogy, and this is what Chester Brown grabs onto, is the fact that in the genealogy, A, it mentions women, which was not done. Because women were not a person at that time. Women were a thing. Mm-hmm. Like women were an object that you owned as a man. So the idea of putting women into a genealogy was cuckoo, bananas.
With the exception of Mary, I would assume.
Mary's not in the genealogy because she's not part of the...
No, I guess she's not in the genealogy, but she was definitely a person in the stories.
The Christian tradition is totally different, right? Okay. At that time period, right? Women had a role in the church and in Jesus' mission, which was unusual in Jewish culture, right? So it presents women, but it's not just women, it's who the women were that is interesting. So we have Rahab, who was the prostitute in Jericho who hides the spies who come there to check out the town. And then they're in trouble, so she hides them from the soldiers. Ruth, who was a Moabite, which is an alien. No Jew could marry a Moabite.
Okay.
So in the Gospel of Ruth, it tells a story of how she got with Boaz in a kind of, I don't know if it's a sneaky way or, no, she, you know, she did her thing and they got married. So good for her. Tamar, who was a seductress and an adulterer. And then Bathsheba, once again, who committed adultery with David. One of the great stories of the Bible, right? Uriah.
All the hits. Yeah, that's one of the ones.
That's a great one.
Play. Yeah.
That's a great one. My favorite part of that is when, is it Daniel comes to him? And he's like, tells a story that relates to David. Because, you know, we'll just quickly tell the story. David loves Bathsheba, sees her sending herself across the way. He's looking at his castle and he sees this woman and he's like, man, this beautiful lady over there. Invite her over. So she's invited over. They have some fun together. Then he's like, then it turns out, oh, I'm pregnant. Then he's like, oh, what have I done? Her husband is fighting. He's away at war.
What a Goliath mistake on my part.
Her husband's away. He's fighting. So David says, well, he sends a message, send Uriah home so he can get it on with his wife. So Uriah comes back. So David's like, all right, you know, and then he gets a report from one of his servants says, you know, David, he didn't actually sleep with his wife. He slept by the city walls. It's like, what the hell? So he invites him over. He's like, why didn't you sleep with your wife? I brought you back so you could have some. He's like, I can't because everyone else I'm fighting with, they're fighting and I can't be enjoying myself. Like, okay, that makes sense. So, well, let's get drunk. So he gets him drunk, sends him home again. It's like, this will work because now he's drunk. He's going to get on with his wife. He doesn't. He goes and sleeps the wall by outside again.
This is a real Three's Company story.
He's like, this is ridiculous.
Yeah.
So now it's no fun anymore because what he does then is he gives Uriah a message to the general commanding the forces and it says, send Uriah into a terrible battle so that he'll be killed. P.S. Don't tell him. So Uriah takes his letter, gives it to his commander in chief. He is sent into this completely pointless battle where a lot of people and himself are killed. And then David is able to take Bathsheba for himself. Then Daniel.
Saying that the baby is Uriah.
Yeah. No, saying the baby is his own.
Oh, because it looks like he had sex with her after
they got married. That's right. Yeah.
Right.
And so then,
seems like the easier thing to do. Sorry, I don't want to be, David's blaming.
Sure.
What I would have done if
Dave's
I was.
Blaming.
I can't be that casual. He was a king. It's what I would have done is this deal.
Okay.
So you already got the guy getting drunk, right?
Sure.
At one point, like really get him drunk. Like
blackout drunk.
Blackout fucking drunk. And then you like strip him nude, get her, get you both naked.
Yeah.
And then when they wake up, her go, that was great last night.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't even remember. I don't remember nothing. No, you were fantastic. Oh, well, good for me. Okay. I guess I was really drunk last night. Well, I got to go off to war. And problem solved. And now you don't got to kill a whole bunch of people. How hard is that? Just get him to pass out drunk. The end. You're doing a drunk thing already.
So then.
Dumb King David.
So then David's done this. And so this prophet comes, who I think is Daniel.
All of David's stories are about from Goliath on are about him getting his rocks off. Anyway, go ahead.
So then
foreskins.
So many foreskins.
Give me more foreskins.
So many foreskins.
We got so many foreskins. We don't know what to do with foreskins. More foreskins. Warehouse.
What I like about the foreskin story is just the idea that you come back with foreskins for King Saul, right? King Saul's like, oh, here comes David. He's conquered a bunch of people. Throws his bag down in his feet. He's like, what's this, some gold? Nope. some silver? Nope. Well, some like animal furs? No. Opens it up.
This is pork rinds.
The bag looks like calamari.
Yeah.
And he's just like, what is it? It's foreskins. Pass it off to. It's like the bad gift, right? You just.
Yeah.
You give it to your.
So what do you do with it?
I don't know.
Yeah.
You re-gift it. You send it on to someone else.
It just keeps coming around.
Then David gets it.
Man.
David finally gets it. Like, what? I gave this to Saul. We didn't appreciate it. God.
No, they're
it.
Different foreskins.
I'll show him.
Oh, okay.
I'll show you. They're different foreskins. No, I recognize these. When you've cut off this many, you know what.
All right. Let me know if you're going to regift this because foreskinned is forewarned. All right. Go ahead.
So then this prophet comes to David and he tells him this story that's like a kind of a cloaked story, basically saying what he's done.
Yeah.
And David says,
a lot of winking, heavy winking.
David says, well, this man should be put in prison. And then the prophet says, you are that man.
Yeah, zing.
That's my favorite. Okay, so now what Matthew was trying to say by doing this, you know, when they're doing this stuff, it has meaning, right? Everything has meaning. They had limited space to write in, for one thing. You know, they had like one parchment.
They had to do it by hand.
They had to do it by hand, and they had one parchment. Yeah. You can't have like a bunch of parchments.
Still autocorrect.
So what he's saying is, there's no longer a barrier between Gentile and Jew, right? Ruth is a Moabite. She's welcome. There's no longer a barrier between man and woman. Women can be part of the genealogy too. Women are part of this history now with us. And then there's no longer a barrier between the righteous and the sinner. That's no longer something that we no longer will make that
right.
distinction between someone who is a Pharisee, someone who is following the Mosaic law, and someone who is a person of the earth, as they were called, a person who you couldn't do business with, who had no legal rights
mm-hmm.
because they didn't follow the exact rules and didn't, you know, ritually wash their hands before each meal,
mm-hmm.
who, you know, walked too far on the Sabbath, who, you know, whatever ridiculous rules there were. There's so many rules to follow by that point. It was impossible, right, to live a life that you somehow you didn't sin. And that's the problem with like a ladder religion, a religion that requires you to meet a, some sort of a requirement to right. move that you can't. So all you do is you frustrate yourself and depress yourself and you make it into an impossible thing.
When you describe all of this, man, that book sounds pretty good. And then you see like the next couple of hundred years of what people decide to do with it and go, boy, you got to really read it all, eh? You can't just go, so you're saying torture people until they believe. No, we're not saying, so we set the ladies on fire who are a bit lippy. No, we did not say any of this at all. So you're saying that's, people of different races can't get married. No, we're not. Okay, but trans people not in the bathroom. What the fuck? You're not, first of all, good for you having indoor plumbing. And secondly.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. So what, so when, now Chester takes this. I don't think it's just Chester. I think this has been written by some other people. And
what are we talking about now? Which story specifically?
The genealogy. He looks at the genealogy, and he says, he says, oh, what are the, so there's two prostitutes in this genealogy, or one prostitute, one potential prostitute in Tamar. What's this telling us? It's telling us that Mary was a prostitute. So Matthew didn't want to put, you know, put it right out there. He's secretly encoding it into this genealogy so that we'll know that Mary was a prostitute. Now, what he does, though, is he does this great thing that you get from cranks of all time. When they're telling you their argument, right, they'll start off like this. Now, what this could be saying is that Mary was a prostitute 4 lines later. Now, we all agree that Mary was a prostitute. So what we have from there, da-da-da-da-da. You're like, well, I didn't agree. Why are we jumping there now? Why is this, you know, so it's just an interesting, he does that quite often, right? So in ancient Hebrew, feet could be sometimes used as a euphemism for penis. That's true.
Okay.
That is an actual fact. That was a thing that they said, you know, just as nowadays we use a former president of the United States, Richard Nixon, as a euphemism for a dick, right? Like for a penis. So
yeah, the problem is when you can, when foot and penis means the same thing, a game of football can be very painful.
But that's the thing. Sometimes it's a euphemism for penis. Sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. So when Mary wept over the feet of Jesus, it's very unlikely that she was weeping over his penis or having sex with him in some sort of sacred ceremony that Jesus was part of.
Are we talking Mary, mother of Jesus?
No, this is Mary Magdalene. Mary Magdalene, yes.
Okay.
Who almost all biblical scholars would say wasn't a prostitute.
I wish they'd just called them both Patty, in which case it would make it so much easier.
Well, there's a lot of Miriams in those days. That's a problem, right? The problem with saying Mary Magdalene was a prostitute is that what you're saying is that, and this probably isn't Mary Magdalene anyway, because in the story, it's just Mary. It doesn't identify her as Mary Magdalene. Okay. It's probably just another Mary. It was a very popular name. Like Jesus was a very popular name at that time. The problem with doing that is that you take this woman who has a powerful place in the story of Jesus, and then you say, oh, but she was a prostitute. That's why she had this freedom. You know, not that in Christ's mission, women had the freedom to be as powerful or as important as men and could play a role in the development of the church, which is true. Women had a credible role in the church until it became the state religion of under Constantinople.
So you're saying it's justifying, or under you're Constantine, saying it's justifying something that doesn't need to be justified. It can just be she was a woman who had power.
Yeah.
And they're saying, well, of course, she would have to be a prostitute because this.
Now, this Mary in this story, yes, she was a prostitute, most likely, because she uncovers her head in public and uses her hair to wash his feet. It's something that no woman who was, you know, an honest woman or whatever you want to say it would do.
Right.
You did not reveal your hair after you were married. Your hair was always covered in public and you would never reveal it to any strangers. So it's likely that she was a prostitute. And that's not, it says that Jesus consorted with, not consorted with, but was with prostitutes. He was also with tax collectors. It doesn't mean that he was out there collecting taxes, you know, or with them, or that he went gambling. It just means that he consorted with those people. So I just feel like Chester Brown has taken these things and it's kind of run in a direction that he wants to go. He's very interested in sex workers' rights and how good it is to have use prostitution as
now,
a way to
now, did you read
have...
the his writing?
I read the entire back.
You read the whole thing?
Yeah,
okay,
I read the
right,
whole thing.
Enough.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, because what it feels like to me, like the first bunch of stories, some are just really basic. Some are, you know, Cain and Abel and, you know, drawn.
But once again, he leaves out interesting things about those stories that, to me, you know, Cain and Abel is... You know, it's part of the widening circle of sin of Genesis, which is a really interesting part of Genesis, is the idea that you start with Adam and Eve, and then you work out from them to their children, to the world, to like the cities, like, so you get the Tower of Babel story, mm-hmm. and you keep, it keeps growing, right? It's an interesting, and it kind of leaves that out, and also leaves out the fact that he says Cain was cursed to wander the earth. Yes, Cain was cursed to wander the earth, but Cain was cursed to wander the earth with God's grace, gracious love, right? He gives him the mark of Cain, which keeps him safe.
They don't really mention that. But it feels like from that story on, like almost all the stories, you know, are, and there's one I think we mentioned last time, which was, you know, the guy who says to his four, you know,
three workers.
Okay, three workers.
Let's talk about that story.
All right, but I'll tell you then sort of the overview, which is like, here's some money, all mm-hmm. of you. I'm going away. One buries it.
Yeah.
One invests it wisely. One prostitutes. Mm-hmm. Comes back. Guy who buries it. You're going to jail, you jerk.
Yeah.
Second one. Oh, I'm kind of mad at you for just investing it and not doing much. Prostitute guy. You're my guy. Good for you. You enjoyed it. You're living life. Good for you. And it feels like almost all, because the Cain and Abel story is, guy murders his brother.
Yeah.
Oh, he's in trouble. When God gets home, God's, okay, well, you're wandering the earth. Go. You're like, wait, God will kill a whole world for wickedness and knock a Tower of Babel down. What? But he's fine with this? And every one of them feels like an EC comic with a twist fucking ending. Like, every one of them is just like, the one guy
that
does
is how the story of
the one
of
guy Cain walks dogs around the block. Hmm. The other guy kicks dogs.
Sure.
And then as we find out at the end, oh, the guy who kicked dogs was right, because they were werewolves. And the other guy who walked dogs, now there's werewolves around, and he's bad for caring for dogs, bad for doing the good thing, and good for doing the bad thing. And every one of these fucking stories is,
Let's talk about
the twist.
Let's talk about the parable of the talents, then, as it's called. Because, okay.
Hey, person that does the right thing. You're a snore.
What Chester Brown does here.
Nerd.
There is a later writer, a Christian writer, whose name was Eusebius.
Okay.
And he wrote.
It's a good name.
He wrote.
I'll admit, it's a great name.
He wrote A History of the Church.
Okay.
Now, we don't have a lot of Eusebius' writings because a lot of them were destroyed in a fire.
Mm-hmm.
And we have even less of another earlier Christian writer named Papias.
I am listening to you while you are talking.
Sure. Who Eusebius was quoting. And he's quoting this, what he calls the Gospel of Matthew, which he says was written in Hebrew, and which seems would be very unusual, because Hebrew was not a common tongue at that point in maybe at that point in Jewish history it was, but in time of Jesus, Hebrew wasn't commonly spoken. It was Aramaic that was commonly spoken. So he talks about this. Now, scholars have kind of looked at this and have sort of developed their own idea that this is actually a separate gospel, which has been called the Gospel of the Nazarenes, and probably written in Aramaic or Hebrew. We're not really sure. But Eusebius quotes the parable of the talents, which has a different story to it than in how it's told in the Gospel of Matthew.
How is it different?
It's different because in the Nazarenes, it includes this character who is out there having a fun prostituting it up. But Eusebius says he is the one who is sent into outer darkness with the requisite gnashing of teeth. In Matthew's story, which I think is a more subtle story, it's three guys. One's given, let's say, 500 or 5 talents, I should say.
Okay.
One's given 2 talents, and one is given 1 talent. So they're all given talents. 2 of them invest them and get a return, and one hides his in the dirt. When the master comes back, he is naturally upset at the guy who hides it and gets nothing for his talent. The story isn't about money. At that time, a talent actually was a weight, not actual money. So let's say it's like so they're given a certain quantity of, let's say, silver. So in Matthew's version, which I think, like I say, is more subtle, it's by repeating the slaves investing the money, but with different amounts, Jesus is telling us that God gives us different gifts. So we're not all the same, right? Which I think is a better twist than having one guy go off and obviously do wrong with it
mm-hmm.
by whoring it up and another guy bury it. So in that way, it's not the talent that matters, but how we use it. And God does not ask us to do more than we can. So he gives us, let's say, a gift. Let's just take away the talents. Let's take away the idea of money. Let's just say gift. God gives us gifts.
Okay.
The gift of life.
All right.
The gift of drawing. The gift of writing.
Okay.
You know, some of us write great, some of us write okay, but we all do the best that we can with our skill, or we should. So the parable is telling us that the reward for work well done is still more work to do. That's one important part of it. So the two characters who do well with the money are given more responsibilities. And that's a good thing, right? Like if you use your talent, say you are a very good manager in a company,
right.
you will get promoted for what you're doing well, right? And that's a good thing.
Hopefully, yeah.
So the person who's punished... The
son also needs a job, in which case he will get it, but that's... Go ahead.
Yeah, well, that's... The person who is punished is a person who will not try. That's the heart of that character, right? And then the universal truth is to the one who has... Which is another one of these famous Bible things, right? To the one who has more... the one who has, more will be given. And the one who has not will lose what little he has. Which sounds cruel, but think of it as still as a gift. So if you use your gift... If you use the talents that God gave you, if you draw and practice your skills, you will be better. If you don't draw, if you don't use your gift, you will lose that gift. You will become a not such a great artist, right? And that's just a fact. That's a fact of life. So to Matthew, most people think he was a Jew, and that's why he has placed so much importance on Jesus' place in the prophecies. To him, the servant who buries his talents is the Pharisees. They're the ones who have done what they said, which is to build a fence around the law, to create this thing and keep it as a immutable, as like the paralysis, like a paralyzed religious truth. And so there could be no development or alteration of that. And so Jesus comes in and he is tearing that down. He's tearing down that fence to free the law. That's what that story is about.
Okay.
Right? Chester takes it, not only does he use a version that we're not very familiar with, that's told in a kind of a half, we're kind of getting it in a paraphrase, but he twists the ending to suit his thing. It seems wrong to do that. And for you, like you say, you didn't bother to read the end notes. So you're missing the fact that, well, he doesn't even say it there, actually. He claims that he's quoting it accurately.
Yeah, and then someone came back to him on that and went, you're completely getting this wrong.
Yeah.
Then Chester went, oh, you're right. I did misinterpret this certain thing.
He still argues.
His point was valid.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess my feeling is this. It's like, if you're telling me a story and I'm reading a novel or some such, and then after the novel is done, there's a whole bunch of explanation of what the novel was about by the author.
Mm-hmm.
Fuck off. Like, just tell it to me in the story, right? You know, I don't want to have to listen to the commentary track to enjoy, understand your movie. You know, so if you don't put it in this, then, you know, no. And I can understand that maybe he's saying, like, the book is the whole thing. You got to read the back as well as the stories in front.
Sure.
And I'm the guy that reads the Rupert the Bear books, and I don't read the story underneath, the long story.
Sure.
I read the rhymey bits up top. Mm-hmm. Rupert was a lovely bear, and he never had a care. Okay, let's just see what Rupert's in, and then the bottom, it's just like, Rupert was in a deep depression. I don't need that. I'll just go with the simple rhyming, uppity bits. That's all fine. Or maybe I'll even just read the top of the page, which is just like, the bear goes on an adventure. Turn the next page, the bear finds a boat. Because there was always three levels of Rupert that you could read.
Oh, I agree with you. I mean, he's done this before. I mean, Louis Riel, the back of Louis Riel is all notes.
But you feel like you can read Louis Riel and not without read the all notes, that, yeah. And you're still fine.
You're right.
Whereas this one, I'm going, well, this is the opposite of how I thought all these stories were. Yeah. And I don't want to have to go back and read the Bible and go like, was this, did I get it wrong?
I did it for you.
Like, there's a bit of me that, like, wants to go to catechism and get a refund sometimes and just go, I think you got this completely wrong and I wasted a lot of years doing this business here, you know. But as a matter of fact, I think I may have yesterday found something when I was like 7, a drawing I did of the prodigal son story.
Oh, yeah.
I may find that and I may scan that in.
Cool.
Yeah.
I just feel like he's, like I said, Chester Brown is, one thing is he's, not only is he pro-prostitution, but he feels like there should be no control on it at all. Like, it should just be, everyone should be allowed to be out there.
Does he feel that the Bible is pro-prostitution?
Yes, that's his argument.
He's not just saying it's existed through history and these are stories of it.
Yeah.
He's saying, you're believing, the Bible is saying prostitution is a positive thing.
Well, yeah, he makes a value judgment. He says there are two streams in the Bible. There's the less enlightened stream that follows the Mosaic Law.
Right.
And then there's the more enlightened stream that is all about sensual love and all that kind of thing.
All right,
and then he starts to go even more further off when because in his notes, as he gets near the end, and you can kind of feel that he's thinking it out as he's writing. He's not just coming at it from a thought out position. Near the end, he starts to incorporate this idea that Jesus was actually worshiping in a goddess religion. You see that a lot in Paul, where he's telling, like, he's writing letters to Romans, writing letters to Corinthians, saying, you know, don't use, you know, don't do prostitution. Like, I don't want anyone, no prostitution, no fornication,
yeah.
which is like, you know, sex outside of marriage yeah. and stuff. Like, that's not us. We're Christians. We don't do that stuff. We don't go to temples and take advantage of the Vestal virgins there and have sex with them.
Right.
That's out.
You gotta get new virgins.
But at that time, temple prostitution was a thing, you know, yeah. in pagan temples and stuff like that. They had their prostitutes, their girls who were raised to work as prostitutes in the temples. And they were used, you know, and I guess that money was used to support whatever. So he's saying, don't do that, you know. And so to Chester, Paul is less enlightened. He's perverting Christ's message, which was all about, yay, prostitution. I'm having sex in temples with prostitutes as part of the goddess faith.
Right.
It's pretty obvious. It's all through the Bible. It's all coded. But you have to, like, if you know the code, it's very clear. So everybody, buy my book, The Bible Code. Explain all this to you.
That's right. With the passages that the church doesn't want you to know about. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, it's a problem for us is, you know, we have these different strains of religious strains, right? One is the Catholic strain of religion. The other is a Protestant strain. Both of them have their problems to me. And Protestantism, you know, started with this idea that what we need to do is think about God. That's all. Just think about God. Put God in the foremost part of your life. So get stuff out of the way that distracts you from God. So we don't need card playing. We don't need people having sex. We don't want people dancing, drinking coffee, having fun. Fuck all that shit. What's important is that you are sitting there thinking about God day and night. That's important.
Right.
So that's still a strain in our culture, right? So we have all these prohibitions on pleasure because pleasure is bad because it takes your mind off God. Rather than pleasure is good because it teaches you how great creation is and what we live in is a place of joy.
And you're enjoying the life that you're
living. Yeah. Now we have this thing that, you know, it's mixed up. It's a mixed up thing.
Well, luckily the Catholic Church isn't. So that's good. what we're saying is they got it right.
I said they had their problems, but I didn't. I was just talking about that in particular.
I think like it's interesting to me, the Chester Brown thing, and this is always going to be weird because, like, you know, we're going to run into him sometime and say, hey, maybe you listen to this. He seems to go to everything that he's mentioned on and comments and stuff. So who the heck knows? If you're listening, hi, Chester. Hope you're doing well. Yeah. But it feels almost like with Joe Matt, because Joe Matt really enjoyed his autobiographical strips.
Yeah.
Some dark stuff.
Sure.
Some interesting stuff. And the last here, by the way, as
finally
is a siren going by. Our rules of the siren game are, as always, guess what this is. And what was that?
It was paramedic, I guess.
A paramedic. Did you guess a paramedic? You didn't. Well, no one wins. The money goes back in the pot, and we'll talk again next week.
No drink for you.
But Joe Matt, for the last couple of issues, it's been about him and pornography and how he's been, like, editing these porno tapes to just get the scenes he wants.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, all the things about him and porn and the porn. And it feels kind of like it's like he's talking about, like, porn's not a bad thing, but the stories he's telling make it seem like porn looks terrible.
I think he thinks it's a bad thing.
Do you think he thinks it's a bad thing?
He's writing about his addiction, right?
Do you think that's what he is?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I'm not 100% sure.
The poor bastard. I think we have a sense that his life is not going.
But the poor bastard was an earlier.
Isn't that what it's called? No, sorry. No,
poor bastard was an earlier thing. Okay. I think what he's doing, and this is, again, I'm just making interpretations here. It's like he's looking at something like a Robert Crumb.
Yeah.
And going like, well, Crumb just says everything that he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
And like he wants to have sex with this, that, and the other, and he's this, and this is everything, and he puts everything out there. But I don't think Crumb ever goes, and I got a problem. I think Crumb just goes, I like all this stuff. This is what I like. I'm just going to present it. It's going to gross some people out. It's going to make some people mad. I don't care. This is who I am. I'm just going to say it all.
Yeah.
Put it all out there. This mm-hmm. is what it is. Yeah. And I feel that's what Joe Matt is doing. I think he's showing, you know, this is what I'm doing in my life. I'm going to put it out there. Not necessarily saying, don't follow my lead. I'm a cautionary tale.
Yeah.
He's just putting this out there. And I think, you know, in doing so, of course, he becomes a cautionary tale where you're like, oh, maybe.
Well, yeah, that- I think. I mean, but, I think he knows that. I don't think he thinks that what he's putting out there, we're not going to judge him.
Right. Well, I don't even mean judge. It's just
you're judging.
No, I'm not really judging. Because if he wants
you're judging. And I don't mean that. If you're going ooh, then you're judging.
Or I don't think you're thinking I ooed Crumb.
But if you look at what he's doing and you say, I don't want to do that, that's a judgment. It's not a bad
thing. No, it's not. Because, like, I see you enjoying sports, and I don't want to do that, but I'm not judging you as, like, you're a bad person or a lesser person for liking sports. You know, whatever you like.
You're not judging him as a good or bad person. You're making a judgment of what you think is a good or way to live your life.
Nah, I'm just saying it's not for me. You know, it's not the thing.
Put it whatever way.
Maybe it does.
Tomato, tomato.
I think maybe I'm wrong. I think like when I'm talking about him, I think it's not necessarily. It's tough. It's because like when I see someone who's addicted to something,
sure.
I'm not necessarily saying. It's weird when you're going with.
I don't see why it's a problem. We judge people all the time. It's something we do. We make value judgments. It's not. It's nothing to be ashamed of.
I've got addictions that are probably as bad. So I'm not. When in the point of judgment, I'm not sitting above him looking down.
No, I don't think. I'm looking
at the thing and going, that is an addiction, and there's a lesson to be learned probably from this.
Sure.
And I'm not saying that he is a lesser person because of an addiction. I'm not saying I'm a better person.
I said you made a judgment. I didn't say you judged him.
Fair. Okay. And I think the same thing is the case. We're not going to do it on this siren, folks, because we're going to be here all the time. I think the same thing is with Chester, though, except that he is actively seeming to proselytizing. That's what I was going. And I wanted to say prostitutizing, and I went, that's not right. But in his prostitution
and the libertarian, so there's kind of these two strains that he's pushing.
Yeah, but the way it comes out, boy, everything sounds bad when you say it like this.
When it spurts out of him,
that's right, and then he pays for it. It's like it again, and I'm not like necessarily against prostitution, but it's just like, well, this is not a good representative for this cause. Like I think what he's trying to present is not what's coming out. I don't think what he wants people to hear is what is being heard.
No.
And it might just be his style.
Yeah.
But I think when you do say something like you have these stories, which is so clearly the opposite of way the stories were presented in the Bible themselves, and you who have some knowledge of the Bible and have studied, you know, lightly, studied the Bible, go, well, clearly that's not it at all.
Sure.
Well, now this seems false. So now that kind of derails everything else he's saying. So now I'm not trusting the other facts I'm putting in big quotes that he's laying down, you know, because, again, he's motivated. You know, but it's like a person who enjoys drugs being pro drug and telling you stories about why drugs are good.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, yeah, but there's a prejudice here, you know, of the person who's telling me this story.
Sure.
And if then I find out some of these drug stories you're telling me are clearly wrong.
Yeah.
Now everything is like off the table and it's just, okay, it loses everything and the table falls over and all the dishes are on the floor and there.
Well, let's look at what Chester does in a different way. Chester does not have sex with someone. I shouldn't say it like this because ideally, in Chester's ideal world, he does not have sex with affection. He does not have intimate sex. He has pay-per-play sex. And it reminds me of Gene Simmons, the bass player for Kiss, talking with Jon Stewart on what he did on The Daily Show.
One of my favorite.
One of your favorite segments. And he talks about how great it was to have sex with all these women and just have all this.
Why would you want to not let yourself have all this pleasure?
Why wouldn't you want to? Yeah, but just pleasure, right?
It's not intimacy. Yourself all this pleasure.
Yeah. And what did Jon Stewart say?
And Jon Stewart said, well, I guess it's, you know, it depends what you consider more important, pleasure or joy.
Exactly.
And like in his marriage, he's got joy, deep joy.
Yes.
And that's a very different thing, yeah.
And that's an important thing. And when we hear that, we make a judgment that sounds better. Most of us say that, right? Some of us don't.
Let's go this. You've got to make judgments for yourself every day. You get up in the morning, you go, I'm going to have cornflakes, I'm going to have oatmeal. And you make a judgment call and you take the cornflakes.
Yeah.
That doesn't necessarily mean you're shaming
I'm not
oatmeal.
Talking about shaming, though.
Right. And you're not thinking lesser of oatmeal.
Yeah.
And if you decide oatmeal, I'm not thinking lesser of you. When you're saying judgment on this, let's just say we're saying it for ourselves.
When you disagree with a person's decisions.
Yeah.
That's a judgment. It doesn't mean that you dislike that person. That doesn't mean I think less of Gene Simmons because he had acres of fantastic sex with a lot of beautiful women. Damn guy. But, you know, that was his choice, right? It's not something that appeals
he
to me.
He seems happy now, doesn't he? He's got the look of of a happy man who,
yeah.
I don't know.
Whatever. I don't know. I am
going to judge Gene Simmons. Let me do that one. He looks like a hole that will never be full. There you go.
Okay, you judged him.
Yeah.
But Chester, now here's the thing with Chester Brown is that in this ideal world, in this world of sex for pay, that we should all take part in because intimate sex in a relationship never works.
Does he say that?
He says that in Paying For It, basically. You know, and so
okay.
But here's the thing:
it never works. So his friends that are in love, they're not working.
He doesn't believe all that stuff. So
is that true, or are you extrapolating?
I'm extrapolating a little bit from what he says, but it's basically what he says in Paying For It, right? I mean, he's making an argument, not only for legalizing prostitution, but as a preferable way to have sexual intercourse. But okay. Here's the thing. Let me just finish by saying this. He says that, but he has used the same prostitute for 12 years. He has had a 12-year relationship with a woman that he pays for sex with her. Mm-hmm. She has sex with other people for money as well. But he has a monogamous pay-for-sex relationship with this person. Mm-hmm. So that is an intimate relationship that has affection in it. It's not something that we can escape. Mm-hmm. You know, we can escape it briefly and have sex with people, with strangers, in whatever situation.
Right.
Whether it's free sex with consenting adults, free sex with consenting groupies, or paying for it.
Or paying for it in other ways.
Or having an intimate relationship with a person that you love and know for a long time, and your sex is a very special thing between you because you've had this relationship for so long that you know each other intimately and super well. That's totally different than just going out there and having fun. Whatever you want to do. I made a judgment. I'm not judging other people for their choices. I don't know what else to say about it. I've run out of things to say about Chester Brown.
Okay. That is a
because
that
that's the, to me that's the last thing you can say about it. It's not for you. I mean, whatever he's saying, and it's not convincing.
This is where I think the flaw comes, and it's tough to say this again. We're trying to beat around the judgmental bush, but I feel like here's
I don't know why you need to.
Here's what the because being judgmental of other people.
We do it all the time.
It points three fingers back at you.
We judge Donald Trump every day. We judge Donald Trump every day.
Yeah, because you've got to, because you've got to make a decision about him if you're an American very soon, whether it's pro or not. So,
but even people in Canada who have nothing, no horse in the race also make judgments.
Because we're trying to influence, hopefully, them.
Yes.
I think this is what it is. It's like you're a person. Every person is different, and certain things. Everyone comes with their certain flaws and pluses and pros and minuses. Mm-hmm. And I can't taste salty things, and I can see far, and I got problems with my hearing.
Sure.
Whatever it is. But I think, like, say you're born with a problem with your hearing, or you develop a problem with your hearing over time. You can't then say the rest of the world should adapt to the problems with my hearing. You can get yourself a hearing aid, but don't then say the rest of the world should all get hearing aids as well, because then we're all going to hear better. It's like, no, this works for you, man. This works for you.
Yeah.
And for other people, and you're right, probably some people do need hearing aids who are going, it's a sin to damage and touch my ears with these hearing aids. And it's like, and they would probably be better off with hearing aids. You're absolutely correct. But don't stick them in everyone's fucking ears, and don't say people who don't have them are, you know, wrong.
Yeah.
Right? This is just you. You found what works, maybe, for you,
mm-hmm.
or what works right now for you. Great. Put your case out there. Yeah. Be an example. That's absolutely fine.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, when you start twisting historical and, you know, semi-historical stories, like the ones in the Bible, to prove your point.
You can call them myth if you like. It doesn't offend me.
What have you. Then you, I think, are on some shaky ground. Yeah, it's weird. Can you twist a myth? I'm going to change.
I think you can.
I'm going to change this myth to be.
I do think you can.
Yeah.
Because the stories, because I believe in someone whose name was Christ. I believe he was a real person, and I believe what he said had real meaning, and is then and throughout history and even now a confrontation and a challenge to us to follow. Still, no matter, you know, we live in a time now, I guess we could call it post-Nietzschean. We live in a time that has a
God is dead situation.
God is dead. Our will is what's most important.
Man and Superman, which has been remade into Batman v Superman.
It's not quite, but anyway, we do live in this time, you know, so what we, you know, as willful individuals who live in this time when, you know, in this world that Nietzsche won the battle, you know, if you want to be a Christian, then you have to fight against that as well, you know, so it's a challenge all the time. And so when you take his stories and you change them to suit what you think that they should mean,
mm-hmm.
your idea of what Christ was saying, you know, then I think that you destroy that message. Now, yes, you can argue that if you want to argue that the disciples changed the message and Christ said different things and blah, blah, blah. Okay, that's fine. But the message that we have from Christ changed the world as the Gospels. That message changed the course of history. We can all agree on that, I think. And so that's the message. That's the world-changing message that we have had handed down to us through generations.
That has been interpreted in infinite directions.
Infinite directions, and yet has a central story that's meaningful yet, right? The resurrection.
Maybe.
Yes, it's very important.
No, I think everyone has their agenda, and that colors it, that. And no, you know, whatever it goes.
What's been called the kerygma is still there. You can still find it if you want.
All right, this is a longer discussion, but fair enough.
You can still find it if you want.
Okay.
It's still there.
So you say.
It's still there.
Very good.
Well, Christ's message is still there for you.
All right.
It's a very simple message. Very simple.
To some people it is, and some people it is not.
It's very simple.
Okay. It's been...
Everybody, it's only two lines, right?
Which is?
What's that?
All right.
Love God.
Yep.
And love your neighbor as yourself.
Right.
And those are the true stories.
And
who is my
taken
neighbor?
And people have taken that baton and run in very different directions
they
with
sure
it.
Have.
Into crowds.
But that's the thing, though.
Over people,
they
through
have
people.
Over people, through people, and yet it comes back to the fact that the correction for that behavior is in that story, right? It's not alien Tharg who came down to the world and said, hey, you guys, what are you doing?
Mm-hmm.
You're making a mess here. No, it's people who look back at the story and say, what are we doing? We're making a mess here. Look what Christ said. What are we doing? Why are we torturing people for this? This is wrong. You guys, I just realized this is wrong.
Yeah, I guess my thing is like, okay, so you take the message, you run and you torture people.
Sure.
And then you realize, I think it's not necessarily going back to the message that you could. You could go back to the message and go, well, that was wrong. Or you could just go, holy shit, I'm torturing people. This can't be right.
Yeah.
This can't be right. I'm hurting people. And there's something inside me that goes, this is clearly wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can, you know, without the use of that message, you can also find, you know, morality and go on from there and be fine.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I will agree that when you take the stories and you completely twist the endings, there's something wrong with that. And you got to really prove that that was, that's weird to me. But again, we'll probably run into him at some point, and it'll be awkward.
I know we have at least one listener and a former guest of the show who hated this whole episode. So I apologize for all the Jesus talk.
Well, you know what? Maybe he used it to fall asleep. This has been the Very Sleepy Podcast. Folks, listen, please don't fall asleep when you come see our live show. That's going to be on May 21st at the Roundhouse in Vancouver.
Or if you do, don't snore.
Don't snore. Lucy Bellwood couldn't be better. James Lloyd couldn't be better.
No judgment.
There's other cartoonists, but we got the best ones, frankly. And she's also has the first name of someone who is in Peanuts.
That's true. There's two Lucys in Peanuts.
Couldn't be better. Yeah, two Lucys. A couple of Lucys. That's what a loose cigarette is called. A Lucy. If you're going to have a Lucy. You do not smoke. You would not know that. That is fine.
You as a long practice smoker, of course, know that.
I smoked very briefly because the girls that were pretty smoked. And it's good to hang around that kind of bad judgment sometimes.
Yes.
Folks, if you want to talk to us, we would love to hear from you. Oh, who knows if maybe an episode on religion and peanuts will spark suggestions and talk, maybe. SneakyDragon.com is our message board.
And corrections. Those are welcome, too.
Sure. Absolutely. We love corrections. SneakyDragon.com is our website, and there's a message board on there underneath every episode, place to post your thoughts. We love to hear them. Even if we don't respond, normally we do, but even if we don't, thanks so much. And thanks for people who gave us stories of being fired. Really enjoyed
those. Yeah, those were great.
Yeah, really enjoyed those. If you want to write us, we are on the email at sneakyd@sneakydragon.com, sneakyd@sneakydragon.com. We're also on Twitter, sneaky_dragon. We are sneakydragon.tumblr.com for calm. Calm down is what it means. And also, we have new t-shirts in our Sneaky store. So go up to the shop. What's it? Shop?
It says Sneaky Dragon Shop.
Yeah. It's better than, it used to be called Jerk Store, and then people went, stop calling it that. Sneaky Dragon Shop, and go to the bottom of the page, you'll see all the new shirts. And if you want one, is it too late to order one for the con if they want one? If they were to say, write us in the next couple of days, is that too?
It might be.
That might be too soon. But
sorry, because a lot of these are new. They have not been set up with our t-shirt maker.
Okay.
So that may require.
So the best thing to do is probably order them off the website proper. Yeah. They will be delivered to your home. Will there be stickers? Probably in there. Probably. Will there be buttons? More than likely. There'll be something. There'll be some extra business in there as well. So every shirt comes with a little bit of. We just fill it with glitter, and ruin your carpet when you open it up.
When you open
and
it up.
And choke your cat.
Yep.
If you're near the cat when you open it up.
That's
as well.
The worst.
All right. So thank you so much for listening. I've been Ian Boothby.
I've been David Dedrick.
And we are judging you harshly. Bye. should release a whole bunch of candies called Judgments.